On average, you and I eat 8 pounds of fresh strawberries every year. On average, each strawberry we eat contains 7.7 different pesticides. And so we ask, can strawberries be mass-produced without pesticides?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with your host, Michael Olson. And now, get ready for 1 hour of What's Eating What Radio.
And thank you, Will Strickland, and hello out there. You are tuned into the 1,104th edition of the Food Chain Radio Show right here on the GCN Radio Network. Or, hey, perhaps you're among our friends up there in Forest who are tuned in as we stream along in the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio with Engineer Jason Struby on the boards. Jason.
It's a pleasure.
Jason, do you, when you eat strawberries, do you eat any kind of strawberries, or do you go for those organic ones?
You know, In the past, I would say any berry is a good berry, but nowadays, I'm not so sure. I'm not so sure about all those extras.
Are you willing to pay the extra?
I sure am.
Okay.
Yes.
Also, Bella Hedke, our intern producer. What about you, Bella? Which strawberry do you go for?
Well, you know, with a college budget, it's very tempting to go for the big flat of non-organic at Costco, but the organic usually just tastes better, so I'll pay for it.
Pay the extra and mm-hmm. eat fewer.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, folks, that's the story of the day. They say in the old days, strawberry farming was a business for gypsies. A farmer could grow the delicious berry for a season or two in one place, but then had those little bugs would congregate underneath the soil and eat up all the plant roots, and the strawberry farmer would have to move on. Then World War II brought pesticides to agriculture, and strawberry farmers learned that they could use those pesticides to stay at home. One of those pesticides was methyl bromide, a gas that, when injected into the soil, kills all the living things in that soil and turns those little things into fertilizer. And the plants love that because they get no competition and they get lots of things to eat. Methyl bromide, together with many other pesticides, made it possible for itinerant strawberry industry to settle down and industrialize. Today, strawberry farmers in some locations can harvest berries from their plants for up to 9 months. But what has been good for strawberry farmers and those who like to eat cheap strawberries comes with a decided caveat. Each strawberry sold in the United States contains, according to the USDA, an average of 7.7 pesticides. Wow. That leads us to ask, can strawberries be mass-produced without pesticides? Well, that's the question we have on the table today. Bella Hedke, we gave you an assignment to pull together a radio show, and lo and behold, you pulled together your place of employment up at UC Santa Cruz. So tell us who you brought to us today.
Well, we have a couple soil scientists from UCSC. They work with the ENVS department, meaning the Environmental Studies Department. We have Carol Shannon, who's a professor, and Margarita Zavata, who is the assistant specialist for researching in the Carol Shannon lab.
Good. And now tell me what you learned when you work in your soil lab up there as a student before we go to our guests.
I think I've been learning a lot of different basic studying techniques. And
so you're learning how to learn.
Yeah, learning with hands-on experience.
Okay, good. And what about soil? What are you learning about soil?
That it's complicated.
Soil isn't just, it's not just dirt, is it? It's not just dirt. Well, let's go to our guests and start with Dr. Carol Shannon, for whom the lab is named. The Shannon Lab at University of California, Santa Cruz. Dr. Shannon, welcome to the Food Chain.
Thank you.
Good to have you aboard. Native from the UK.
That's right.
And you were raised out in the sticks in the UK.
Yes, in the Fens, in the east of England.
Mm-hmm. And what brought you into the world of soil science? How did you wake up one day and thought, I'm going to be a soil scientist?
Well, actually, I'm trained as a botanist, of all things. But you can't really...
So you start on the other side of the ground, right?
Yes, but you can't really understand how plants grow unless you understand the soil. And so more and more over time, I started integrating, looking at both the plants and soil.
You know, around here, you have to be a greenie to get by. You know, if you're not a greenie, people look at you and think, eh. But I always often thought of myself as a brownie, because I don't think you get to the green until you go through the brown first.
No, that's right. You don't.
Yeah. So you studied botany and matriculated from UK to Australia to UC Davis and then UC Santa Cruz.
That's right.
Good. And what is the objective of your soil lab up there? What do you do?
Well, I work on two main areas. The very capital-intensive agricultural systems we have here on the Central Coast, focusing on vegetable and strawberry production. Mm-hmm. And then the other half of my lab works in sub-Saharan Africa, a rather different kind of production system, where soil fertility and soil management is critical for food production.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, so I work in two worlds.
When you say sub-Saharan, what does that mean?
Anything south of the Sahara.
Okay.
But currently I'm working in Senegal primarily.
Wow. And that's kind of like savanna.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. It transitions from almost desert at the north through savanna to wet savanna in the south.
What caused the Sahara?
Do we have a whole hour to talk about that?
Just out of curiosity. Yes.
Well, I mean, it's part of the global weather system that mm-hmm. leads to a desert in that part of the those latitudes.
So something about the area just didn't quite work.
That's right.
Was it always a desert?
No, not always, but for a significant period of time.
Long time. But if you go back
geologically speaking, no, it wasn't.
Okay. Yeah, I better avoid this one because this one, I could just wander off on this direction for a long, long time. Well, also with us, Margarita Zavata. And Margarita, you're not from the UK.
Hi. No, you're right. I'm not. But not too far from the UK. Italy is my home country.
And you have a background in agriculture as well.
Yes. My background is in biology and ecology, and I started to study nutrient cycling in soil, and after that I got interested in food systems. I thought, how can I make the difference in farming without really knowing how farm system works? So this is what actually led me to come to United States and study more in food system, and then I found Carol Labs and her research very applied, and I was very happy. It was very beautiful to work with her for the past 6 years.
Well, Bella, our intern, who was raised in a rural community up in Northern California, discovered that soil is very complex. How complex is soil?
It's incredibly complex. And for so long, scientists sort of treated the soil as a black box. You know, we knew that we put things in and we got things out, but we didn't really understand that much about what happened in between. And over the last, I would say, 20 years, there's been a real explosion in trying to understand not just the chemistry and physics of soil, which have been studied for a long time, but also the biology of soils.
Why in the last 20 years only? I mean,
well, I think in part it's because we have better techniques now to be able to identify what's in the soil. I mean, there's a whole host of animals of different kinds, arthropods.
We never thought about that before, did we?
Well, and we knew that there were bacteria and fungi, but until we had the advent of the DNA techniques, we could only culture about 1% of the microbes that are in the soil.
Mm-hmm.
So trying to work out what was happening and who was doing what was impossible if you only know what 1% of the organisms there are.
Now, another element in that could have been the consumer interest in a different way of eating. And, of course, when you talk about University of California, Santa Cruz, one of the characters that brought this whole different way of thinking about things to the university was a guy named Alan Chadwick, who, interestingly enough, was a Shakespearean actor from the UK
mm-hmm.
who had a whole different notion of how you could grow food, and he called it French Intensive Biodynamic. Biodynamic. What the heck does that mean?
Well, biodynamic comes from the teachings of a German, actually, Rudolf Steiner, who thought about soil and plants as a whole interacting or sort of superorganism almost, and a way of life. And that led to a whole philosophy of farming that Chadwick followed.
And a whole different way of looking at the soil.
Yes.
And the realization that, wow, this is a real complex world. How are we going to deal with it? Folks, this is the Food Chain Radio program. Today we're looking at strawberries, but all crops, really. Is it possible to mass produce those crops without using lots of pesticides? You're invited to participate. If you so desire, pick up your phone, 831-479-1080. Let us know about what you think. Do you like those strawberries that come with an organic label, or do you pay less and get the conventional berries that do have the pesticides in them? Do stay tuned. Food Chain Radio program, right back.
Uh-oh. You can dream it, build it, own it, Metro Farm it. You can sow it, feed it, grow it, Metro Farm it. You can harvest it and dry it. You can sell it, Metro Farm it.
Learn how to dream it, build it, sow it, seed it, grow it, harvest it, sell it, Metro Farm it. Yes, you can do it. Dream it, build it, earn it, own it, Metro Farm it.
Oh, learn it, do it, earn it, Metro Farm it. Dream it, build it, own it. It's easy, you can do it, Metro Farm it.
It's all in Metro Farm, the guide to growing for the city. Get your copy today at metrofarm.com.
It's easy, you can do it, Metro Farm it. And now, back to What's Eating What on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Welcome back, folks. You know, the Environmental Working Group has been surveying produce for a number of years. In the last couple of years, strawberries have come out as being the most contaminated with pesticides fruit on the market. Each strawberry we eat, and we eat an average of 8 pounds a year, each strawberry contains an average of 7.7 pesticides. That's from the USDA survey. So why has our strawberry industry become so reliant on these chemicals to mass produce strawberries? So I think the thing to do is go back some time to before there were chemicals. How did they grow strawberries, Carol?
Well, they grew them with straw laid between the beds of strawberries to protect the berries and cover the soil.
To keep them off the soil.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That's strawberries.
And they would grow them for one or usually 1 year, maybe two, and then grow other things in rotation with the strawberries. And the yields were much, much lower than we have today.
Yeah, and for a much shorter period of time. I remember in my native Montana, you could have delicious strawberries, but only for a few weeks.
Yeah, well, growing up in the UK, you know, I grew my own strawberries in my backyard, and we would have them for most of the summer. But if you kept growing them for more than 2 years, you got such bad pest problems that you had to give them up.
So what happens in the soil that you have to rotate? You can only grow for a year or two. What happens in the soil?
Well, what happens is that pathogens, notably fungi, but sometimes nematodes or bacteria, they may, you know, like strawberry as a host, as a thing for them to eat. And if you keep growing strawberries in the same place, then they've got more and more of a food supply.
Food's on.
Yeah. And so they multiply and build up in the soil until it gets to a point that, you know, they're going to kill off the plants.
Do you ever wonder how those little tiny bugs can communicate with each other and let each other know that dinner's on, you know, that strawberry plants are ripe for eating?
Oh, yeah. And people are looking at that. There are all kinds of chemicals that are used to signal.
To talk with each other.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So sometimes when the anchovies are running in the Monterey Bay, pelicans will show up and other whales will show up. And you always wonder how they communicate with each other for such great distances, but happens in the soil as well. During our break, when I asked you what goes on in the soil, you said a lot of competition. What are they doing?
Well, there are literally millions of microbes in a teacup of soil.
Millions in
millions.
A teacup.
So they're all competing with each other for getting what food they can use. And so one of the things we're interested in is other ways of tipping the balance in favor of the beneficial microbes and suppressing the capacity of the pathogens.
So it's almost like the strawberry plants create an imbalance of bad bugs for some reason.
Well, if they're present for a long time. I mean, that's the thing. If you have some bugs will only eat certain things. Other bugs will eat almost anything that's there. So it varies from bug to bug. But if you grow strawberries if they're in the ground for 11 months of the year, that's a constant food supply for things that like to eat strawberries. And so,
So in the old days, strawberry farmers were like gypsies, kind of had to keep on the move.
Yeah, and many organic farmers today still rotate for 4 years or more between strawberry crops.
Wow.
For that reason.
Which makes them very expensive then.
Yeah, because you're not growing strawberries every year or every other year. So, and you can make much more money growing strawberries than you can anything else.
So very precarious business then when you have to keep rotating. And so that's why it's so convenient to use the pesticides. World War II came along and with it pesticides. How did those pesticides change the dynamic of strawberry farming?
Well, in this area in particular, it had a dramatic effect.
So we're talking California Central Coast here.
Yes, yeah. Because it allowed farmers to grow strawberries year after year, sometimes without rotating at all. Sometimes they would rotate for just 1 year. But because you could control the main diseases that are transmitted through the soil, then that made the whole industry a really economic created an economic boom for strawberry industry.
It allowed the industry to industrialize, essentially.
It did.
Then one of the big pesticides or elements that they use is methylbromide. Tell us a little bit about that chapter in the history.
Yeah, methylbromide was the usually mixed with chloropicrin. Together, they're both called soil fumigants because they kill pathogens in the soil.
Does anything survive it?
Yeah, some microbes do.
Really?
Yeah. There's usually, from our data, fewer microbes in the soil after you've fumigated, but it's not none. There are still some. Bacteria are remarkably resilient organisms. But many things are killed. A lot of soil organisms are killed with methylbromide. Mm-hmm. The advantage of methylbromide was that it did kill almost all of the pathogens and weeds. And so there was nothing that was going to limit your production of strawberries
and all of those
from the
things
soil.
And all of those things that were in the soil become fertilizer.
Yes. Yeah, so actually the berries would have a growth spurt.
Boom.
In response to methylbromide. And so that allowed the industry to really expand and industrialize. Mm-hmm. And it also allowed for farmers to specialize in just producing strawberries.
There you go. So that's all we do.
Because it requires
now.
Specialized right. types of beds, specialized equipment, specialized management.
And of course, the more specialized they become, the greater the opportunity to increase production with what you're doing because
that's
you
right.
really develop that expertise.
That's right.
And so when you see the strawberry country, but almost all crops are that way when it gets right down to it. Every crop seems to have become a specialized crop now with its own set of chemical guidelines, as it were.
Well, that's right. And so we saw a sort of a division among Central Coast farmers between strawberry producers and vegetable producers.
Right.
That you tend to specialize in one or the other.
One or the other. And they don't rotate? Why don't they rotate?
Well, when they with methyl bromide, you didn't need to rotate. And but if you did rotate, what you would do is lease your land to a vegetable grower. And while the strawberry growers are using methyl bromide, that's a good deal for the vegetable growers because they know there won't be any diseases
for
the vegetables either.
Right.
So it was worthwhile for vegetable growers to lease strawberry
to develop.
Yeah.
Wow. Okay. And so we've developed quite an industry that has industrialized. It produces incredible amounts of strawberries now.
About 90% of the country's strawberries.
90% of the country's strawberries. And we produce a lot of them, and they are beautiful. But 7.7 pesticides each would indicate that it's not just soil fuming. Now, going back to methyl bromide, it's been made illegal, right?
Yeah, it's been phased out through the Montreal Protocol because it's an ozone depleter.
Right.
And it was originally meant to be phased out by 2005, but because of the reliance of the industry and some others, there was a process where you could apply for an exemption and keep using methyl bromide, and that would be approved every year. But the last, what was called critical use exemption, was in 2015-16.
Well, what did they do to replace it?
They've shifted to using other fumigants primarily, notably chloropicrin and telone are the main ones in strawberries.
So then it's methyl bromide's gone, but the next is here. Is the next safer?
Has different issues.
Okay. All right. Food Chain Radio Program. Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio. Today we're talking about the strawberry industry, but really, you know, what we're talking about, strawberries, it could really be applied to just about anything because it's the nature of our agriculture these days. And the question we have on the table today is, can we get by mass producing our food without using all the pesticides? Is it possible? That's what we're looking at. We're looking at those bugs in the soil. How can we manage them without killing everything? This is Food Chain, right back.
Let's go back for more of What's Eating What on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Well, there are lots of things eating everything else in the soil. In one cup of soil are how many bugs eating each other, Carol?
Many millions.
Many millions. So when we say what's eating what, it's a beast in the soil. One of the things that strawberry growers, probably a lot of growers, have trouble with is Verticillium wilt. Tell us a little bit about that critter. Okay. Marguerite.
Well, Verticillium wilt is one of the many fungi that live in the soil. And the real tricky part of in controlling Verticillium is that it can be hosted by a very high number of different crops. So as we were saying, as Carol was saying before, the advantage of using pesticides like methyl bromide was that farmers didn't need to rotate anymore.
So you could use methyl bromide, kill everything.
Kill everything and go ahead and plant your next year of strawberries. So now, what, for example, organic farmers can do to control disease in the soil is to rotate. Now, if your host, disease can be hosted by a very high number of different crops, that becomes very challenging for farmers to manage their rotation.
So what do you put in rotation that won't host the Verticillium wilt, right?
Exactly. That's exactly the problem that they have. And the problem that they have is how to make their rotation economically viable as well. What our lab is studying in the past probably 10 years now is how to try to reduce the impact that Verticillium dahlia has on our mainly strawberry crops. And we looked at different rotation, and we're using a technique that is a pre-plant technique.
Pre-planting?
Yes. Okay. It's like the fumigation. It comes before you plant your crop in. And it's called anaerobic soil disinfestation. And it's a very simple, in a way, method because we're using we let the soil, the biological components in the soil, to do the work. So what we're doing, we're feeding the microbes in the soil, adding a carbon source, really decomposable carbon source. One of the main results we had is by using rice bran. And we apply the carbon source, and we keep the soil by adding, we keep the soil anaerobic for about 3 weeks.
Which means no water. So you're kind of flooding the soil there.
Yeah. We're flooding the soil, exactly. Okay. And it's a combination of flooding and solarization that happen in the soil, plus switches in the microbial community there are in the soil. So when the anaerobic environment take place, there are a different set of bacterials that feeds on the soil, that feeds on the carbon source that we added, changing the composition of our microbial community.
Wow.
Now, as Carol was saying before, when you apply fumigants, they can be methyl bromide, or now it's called pyrethrine, you kill your community. Your soil community, microbiological community is
like
lower.
Like taking antibiotics now, for something, you
exactly.
kill all the bugs, right?
With our system, actually, we proved that the microbial community is actually increasing, so creating probably competition in the soil.
Wow. Well, Bella was talking about earlier about how she learned that the soil environment is really complex. Dr. Carol, this sounds really complex.
Yeah. Just one thing I wanted to say. It's using the principles of flooding soil, but we don't actually flood because we don't have the water for flooding.
So I was wondering.
So what we do is we make the beds and cover them with plastic and then add water through drip irrigation until the soil is as wet as it can be, but that's not so wet that the beds collapse, because that would be a problem if you added too much water. So we usually add only about an acre inch of water in addition to what would normally be used for making the beds.
Mm-hmm.
So
the principle's the same.
But the principle's the same. It's creating a soil without oxygen for a period of time.
Right.
And, and so, as Margie said, we create different soil environment, and some of the bacteria that thrive in the absence of oxygen, they ferment the carbon that's in the soil. And some of the byproducts of that fermentation are toxic to pathogens.
Wow. So, and thus what you're really trying to do is manage the life in the soil by increasing the life in the soil.
That's right. And creating specific kinds of life in the soil. And what's interesting is we found that even almost 2 years after applying that technique, we still see a reduction in Verticillium Dahlii in the soil, even 2 years later after growing strawberries, cover crop, lettuce crop.
Okay. So now you've got this whole new way of managing soil, and you take it to the strawberry industry, and they say?
The strawberry industry has actually been really supporting the work. I think in large part because there's a recognition that the consumer would like to see strawberries grown with fewer pesticides and without fumigants. And so for a number of years now, the industry has worked on alternatives to soil fumigants. And this is one of the big projects that they funded for a number of years.
Mm-hmm. So, and of course, who really wants to eat strawberry with 7.7 different kinds of pesticides? You know, we all want to eat clean pesticide-free food. And so you're really looking for a way to make this happen.
Yeah. And 5 years ago, we had one farmer who would try this technique in his field. And then last fall, we had 1,500 acres of strawberries grown with this technique. So farmers are trying it.
Mm-hmm. I remember, you know, quite a while, I've been doing this for too long, but I remember I have a good friend who was a strawberry grower, and I was out visiting his ranch one day, and he said, "I'll show you my organic plot." And so he took me to his organic strawberry plot, and the poor plants were just you know, little tiny puny things. And he said, see, it doesn't work. And I said, well, what did you feed the soil? And he said, what do you mean? So his notion of organic was just no pesticides, but it's not that way. What you're talking about is adding life to control life. Wow. Well, there you go. Folks, this is the Food Chain Radio Program. We're going to go to the phones, talk with you out there. What do you think? Do you think we can mass produce strawberries without using all the pesticides? Furthermore, that goes with all the crops that we grow. Corn, soybeans, you name it. Is it possible that we can use our intelligence and life to manage life? This is the Food Chain. 831-479-1080 is the phone number. With us today, University of California Professor of Soil Science Carol Shannon, Assistant Specialist Margarita Zavata, produced by Bella Headke, UCSC student, and you. So if you want to participate, 831-479-1080. Love to hear what you think. Can we do it without all the pesticides? Right back.
And now, more of What's Eating What on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Welcome back, folks. This is the Food Chain Radio Program, talking about strawberries, but talking about all crops and can we grow them without pesticides. We have Professor Carol here from UC, Professor of Soil Science, UCSC, Assistant Specialist Margarita Zavata. And you, we're going to go to the phones right now. We're going to start with Tom. Tom, welcome to the Food Chain Radio Program.
Hey, good morning. So I guess my question is, you know, if this was a talk show about building houses or fixing cars, you know, would the question be, you know, how can I build a house or fix a car without using the tools in my toolbox?
Oh.
You know, like, why would you ask that question? And to specifically to something like ASD, which has a place and it works and all that to a certain extent in certain circumstances, but why is it better to go through the extra cost of doing that, of hauling organic material hundreds of miles from its source point, going through all this rigmarole to create a bacteria or a complex of soil organisms that themselves are creating toxic chemicals to kill other soil organisms, and at the end of the day to somehow say that's better than using a controlled manufactured substance that can be used in a very controlled, known fashion, known input, known result. Why do you assume that that's better?
Well, Dr. Carroll?
Well, I think we're comparing two very different kinds of chemicals in the sense that the organic acids and volatiles produced during ASD are broken down very readily by aerobic bacteria. And so within a short period of time of allowing oxygen back into the soil, those chemicals have disappeared. So they have no significant half-life in the soil, which is not the same with necessarily all pesticides. So, but I take your point. I mean, here we're trying to use the potential mechanisms of competition between bacteria to reduce the viability of the pathogens. So it's a more subtle approach, I would say, and it's one that doesn't leave any residues in the system.
Margarita?
But do we really know, though? I mean, nobody really knows all the chemicals that are being produced by those soil microorganisms and what the interactions are. I know nobody's studied the total cycle of all that. We couldn't have. We don't have enough time and money to do it. So, I mean, that's like making an assumption. And I have nothing wrong with the process. I have nothing wrong with ASD, especially in the organic construct. But the conversation seems to be that somehow that is better than whatever the definition of a pesticide is today, which I'm not even clear on. I just have trouble wrapping my head around all that. It doesn't seem to follow. And the total footprint, environmental footprint of that process has never been studied relative to creating those same chemicals in a factory and applying them carefully with a machine.
Yeah.
That's you see, that's where I'm going with it.
Yeah, and actually we are studying the environmental footprint, and we'll have that information available fairly soon.
Okay.
And it does come down a lot to where you're getting the carbon source from.
Yeah.
And that's why we've been trying to look for a variety of different materials that are essentially at the moment used as waste products with very little use or disposed of, you know, in various different ways. So that's why we started with rice bran, because it was a waste product. But now that's become an animal feed. So it's become more expensive. So we're looking at things like grape pumice and almond hulls and other kinds of agricultural waste, because then it's not a, it, you know, not increasing the footprint. You're just recycling what's already been produced. But I take your, you know, you've got a good point. You know, the most toxic chemicals we know of have been produced in nature. So just because something is natural doesn't necessarily mean there's no toxicity to it.
There you go. Yeah, that's good. I wanted to hear somebody say that. The other question I have is, you talk about verticillium, but what can you tell us about ASD and Fusarium strawberries? And I'll take that off the air.
Thank you for the call, Tom.
Yeah, that's a very good point, because at this point we know that ASD can control verticillium, and we have a pretty good idea of under what conditions. Fusarium is much more difficult to control with ASD, because all the evidence is suggesting the soil temperatures need to be very high as well to control the Fusarium. It's controlled effectively in Florida and some other places. And that makes it more tricky in coastal California, because it means you'd have to do ASD in the middle of the summer, which doesn't fit so easily with the cropping cycle.
Rory, welcome to the food chain.
Hey, thank you. And yeah, what about, have we looked at Macrofemina as well with ASD?
Yeah.
Do you have any data on that?
It reduces it. It doesn't, in the trials we've done, it hasn't completely eliminated it. But for example, we worked with a farmer in Oxnard, and we doubled his organic yields by halving the amount of Fusarium, I mean of Macrofemina, But we haven't think we need to do it under higher temperatures to completely eliminate it.
One other thought is, I know when you use the rice hulls for ASD, you're effectively adding about 200 pounds of nitrogen to the acre.
Yeah.
And what, I mean, you really can't separate that nitrogen bump from the control as much, right? I mean, from the controlling of the pathogen and the fungal pathogens. And so are these other alternatives you're looking at, like almond hulls or other sources of carbon, do they not give you that big nitrogen bump that the rice hulls do?
Yeah, no, they don't. And so what we would look at with using grape pumice or almond hulls is you'd probably still need to use pre-plant nitrogen. But if you're using rice hulls, we recommend that you don't use any pre-plant nitrogen, because you don't need it.
Because you don't have to have it.
Right. The other question is, following up on Tom's comments or questions, is what is our understanding of the toxins that are produced by the bacteria in that ASD process?
Okay, we'll have to pick that up when we come back from the break. Roy, do stay tuned. Right back. This is the Food Chain.
Here's a little secret I'm telling you. Take a little pledge called the 2x2. Spend $2 on local food each day and get two friends to do the same and play. Oh, they'll spend their money, and when they're through, they'll get two friends and do it too.
We can eat our way to economic security and personal freedom. It won't cost an extra dime, and it will be so easy, it will make you blush. All it takes is two numbers. One is two, the other is 2-2. Join us. Take the 2x2 pledge.
There's a little secret I shared with you, a simple pledge called the 2x2. You can do it. It don't cost much. It's so easy, it'll make you blush. Pledge two local bucks each day. Get two others to pledge and play.
Take your 2x2 pledge at MetroFarm.com.
2x2.
History buffs, this tale from Michael Olson's Tales from a Tin Can took place aboard the USS Dale at Eniwetok, February 1944.
We got detached for some close-in shore bombardment on one of the little coral islands. From a distance, they're just little slivers of white and green separating the blue sea and sky. Somehow we found ourselves blasting away with our 5-inchers from one side of the island, while the big old battleships on the other side were booming away with their giant 16-inch rifles. Trouble was, the trajectory of their rounds was flat, so a bunch of those 16-inch shells hit that round slip of coral and ricocheted right off in our direction. You could hear them roaring past right over our head, and they didn't sound friendly at all. Captain said, "Let's get the hell out of here."
Tales from a Tin Can contains 424 tales by 44 sailors aboard the USS Dale, from Pearl Harbor to Tokyo Bay. Order your Father's Day copy at talesfromatincan.com. That's talesfromatincan.com. talesfromatincan.com.
So much to say, so little time to say it, on The Food Chain with Michael Olson.
And we want to be sure and get Wendy in, who has a question or a comment about GMOs and pesticides. Wendy, fire away.
Well, actually, it was GMO pesticides in the GMOs when we had the BT toxin, which is like jellyfish sting, that was put direct to the cellular structure of the plants. And I think that was a couple years ago. And I don't know if that was effective, but on our last, a few callers back, we had someone going off on how we should be very, very afraid of rotting matter, which has been happening on Earth since Earth pretty much had plants, and that all these chemicals and industrial new ideas we should not worry about, and especially with the BT toxin, because I guess it's been used for a very long time as a pesticide, but we're supposed to have been able to digest it because it's a protein and we have the ability to digest proteins. But with the BT toxin inside the cell structure, it just kind of went through us and kind of like didn't do very good to either the bacteria in the soil, which is...
Wendy, I have a quick question for you.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think we can grow mass-produced strawberries or any other crops without using pesticides?
Oh, absolutely. As long as we don't have them messing with our soil, which is the problem with bringing in this, the chemicals and GMOs, that we do not have any idea how they're going to, affect everything.
Let me ask you this, Wendy: Do you think Carol and Margarita and people who are like them are working on ways of developing biologically intense soils? Do you think they will be able to find a way to grow our crops without using pesticides?
Absolutely. I think it's, I do a pretty good job. I do my own composting up here in the Redwoods, and I like with like, and you have to have organic matter in a soil, and kind of forgetting that and for us to assume that we should not know what is going on biologically is ridiculous, just because we haven't found a way to make a dollar on it because
well,
we
that's,
can't patent
that's
it.
My question, though. Do you think we can do it on an industrial scale?
Oh, yes. Yes.
Dr. Carroll, what do you think?
I think we can move towards that. I think the issue with strawberries specifically is that we have some real challenges in terms of diseases that have widespread hosts. And so many of the methods that we use, for example, are in our organic systems, they don't control that particular pathogen very well. And so techniques like the ASD or something is needed to help bring the productivity up to the level that we would need for a viable industrial model.
Margarita, what do you think?
Well, I think that we definitely can work towards it, and we can do it is working with the farmers. So this is what we've been doing for the past years, and I think there's a key component of the whole process because they are the first actors in this. And I think there's like California's Central Coast is a very good place to do it.
And
farmers are very receptive to this.
One of the reasons is that our farmers are really smart.
Absolutely. And to manage biological systems requires a lot of knowledge.
Okay. Thank you both for joining us, the Shannon Labs at UCSC. Folks, thank you all for tuning in. I want you to remember Michael Olson's third law of the food chain. Cheap food isn't.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with Michael Olson. And if your friends missed the show, tell them to log on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com for a listen. Now, go out and find some food with its farmer's face on it and live.